Hello, revelers and revisers, family rememberers and set the record straighters, also seekers of inspiration or redemption or deliverance. Today's interview is an installment from Women Lit, an organization that I'm very grateful to be engaged with and which She Writes sponsors and supports. Women Lit is a year-round series focusing on bringing female-identified authors to the Bay Area. With a focus on elevating women's voices, Women Lit has hosted some of the great feminist thinkers and authors of our time, including Gloria Steinem, Terry Tempest Williams, Rachel Cusk, and Eve Ensler. And now we're happy to add Chelsea Beaker, author of Godshot, to this amazing list of writers. This year has been a topsy-turvy one, as we all know, and when the Bay Area Book Festival had to be canceled back in March, the organizers were swift to bring it online as the Bay Area Book Festival Unbound. And this is how I came to interview Chelsea back in May, and why I'm without my trusted sidekick, Grant Faulkner, today. That said, Grant and I are both so honored to be part of the Bay Area Book Festival, and we love these opportunities to share with you the deep dive interviews we do as part of that community programming. I'm really excited to bring you Chelsea Beaker's interview today because I loved Godshot. It's an intense novel whose protagonist, Lacey May, finds herself deeply entrenched in a cult because her grandmother and her mother are a part of it. And before she and her mom started going to this church, life was pretty miserable for Lacey May. Her mom was an alcoholic, always bringing different men around. But soon enough, things turned sour inside the cult too, needless to say. And Lacey May's mom is pushed to her limits, driven back to her habits of alcohol and men by the cult leader's assignment. Getting an assignment is supposed to be a blessing, showing that you're chosen. But these assignments are sinister and often sexual in nature. Lacey May is coming of age in the Central Valley in the midst of a terrible drought, so bad that bottled water is precious, and the people in town have their lawns painted green. This is a story of a daughter who loses her mother, first to men and alcohol, then to faith, then to men and alcohol again, and sex work, and the trappings of promises and fame. It's a sad story in a lot of ways, but in keeping with the best feminist coming-of-age novels, the redemptive parts soar. Lacey May is nobody's victim, and I think this interview with Chelsea showcases the fighting spirit of her protagonist in all its glory. So I hope you'll enjoy the interview as much as I enjoyed the conversation with Chelsea. What you're about to hear is just a portion of the interview, and if you'd like to watch the whole thing, you can find us on YouTube in living color at the official Bay Area Book Festival video channel. Chelsea Beaker is the recipient of the 2018 Rona Jaffe Writers Award. She is the author of the novel Godshot and the collection of stories Cowboys and Angels. Her work has been published or is forthcoming in Granta, McSweeney's Quarterly, Catapult, Joyland, The Cincinnati Review, and others. Her work has been supported by the McDowell Colony and the Tin House Writers Workshop. She holds a BS in journalism from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo and an MFA in creative writing from Portland State. She has taught since 2011. I hope you enjoy this interview. Welcome. So good to be on with you. And I feel like in the first couple of questions, I'm hoping that you'll set a little bit of context for your book, because I don't know that all listeners will have read it. It's about so many things, but one of the things it's about is the protagonist is drawn into a cult. And cult writing is kind of a genre all its own. And the Chicago Review noted this, saying that there have been a lot of feminist coming of age meets cult novels, and Godshot is a worthy addition. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about setting the context for that, and I want to ask what you knew about this canon before you started Godshot, and whether you were inspired by any of these novels, or whether Godshot came more from your personal experience.
Yeah, I think overall Godshot really started with my personal experience. Earlier drafts of the book were so focused on the mother-daughter relationship and this tiny town. And there was a church that was definitely a part of the town. But with each draft, I deepened the complexity of that church, and slowly it sort of rised up as more of an influence on the people of the town. I think when I was thinking about the environment and the way I wanted to heighten different tensions of the book, it sort of happened organically, but looking back, I can see it clearly that maybe it was an attempt to get the environment even more claustrophobic than it already was by having this cult influence on the town. And I definitely grew up in a church environment for part of my childhood. I didn't personally experience what's in the book, this really tiny town in the cult, thank goodness. But I think I was witness to a lot of groupthink and sort of these overarching truths of my church community around things like women's bodies and sex and women in leadership that felt claustrophobic and felt kind of culty in their own way. And so I think some of that's infused here. And of course, it's fiction. So I'm always finding or trying to find ways that I can really heighten the tensions and get characters in close proximity to one another to really see who they are.
And you do that very effectively. And so I want to, again, maybe set a bit of context and ask you a bit of a personal question, which is, of course, out there online to find. But your own mother left when you were 9. And there are some pretty clear overlaps in Godshot with your own life. Your mom was also an alcoholic, also fell in love with a man that she met on the phone. And I work with a lot of memoirists, and mother abandonment is one of those topics that shows up a fair amount. And it feels so baked into the DNA of writers who are unpacking this topic. So my question is whether you considered writing Godshot as a memoir.
That's a great question. I think, so in my early 20s, when I entered a MFA program for fiction and was primarily writing fiction at that time. And I took this memoir writing class as sort of an elective. And I kind of strode in thinking like, I know my own story. This will be a piece of cake. I know what happened. And I sat down to write this personal essay that was assigned and really was met with a lot of blocks. I really couldn't access the truth of my own story at all. And I felt this emotional upheaval and fear come up when I tried to. I just don't think I was ready on my sort of self-growth journey to dive into some of those topics head on. And so fiction was more of this intuitive way to get at the emotions that I was feeling without actually looking at my exact life. And as I've, you know, that was 10 years ago. And now I am dabbling a little bit with personal essays and writing more head on toward the truth of certain things. But fiction has just always appealed to me as the way that I can access my truth in this freer way, I guess. At times in the book, I would be writing about the mother and daughter together. And I would think, well, just say what happened. Just write what happened to you, because that's a good story. But I don't know. I just felt blocked to really do that. And fiction just seemed like the way in. And I do think, and I hope that one day I will write a memoir. I want to, I feel compelled to, but I'm not sure I'm ready yet. And I think I'll know when I'm ready. I'm getting closer, but I'm just not there yet. So, yeah,
that makes a lot of sense. I'd love to go back to the book for a second. This, for those who haven't read it, Lacey May is your protagonist. She is growing up in this. It's fictional, obviously, because the drought is bad, but maybe not. Hopefully, this bad in real life. So in this town, the drought is so severe and the people have sort of been taken up with this fundamentalist man who claims that he can save them by bringing water, which has happened once before. So I just kind of wanted to give people that context. So I wondered if you could tell the readers or the listeners out there rather, because I thought it was so interesting what it means to get Godshot. And after this happens to her, you know, this based on an assignment that she's given, there's moments when Lacey May basically wishes that she could go along with it. You know, there's this wishful thinking. It happens several times in the book where she realizes her life would be easier if she just could go along with it. And I wondered if you could talk about that in general. I mean, I think it's a human tendency, but why you had her in that space of just saying, well, what if, you know, what if I could just be okay with all of this and then I would be okay?
Yeah, I think you're right. It is kind of a human tendency to want to feel like we are agreeing to the right things, that we're in the right place in life, that we found perhaps the ultimate meaning of life. I think in some ways we search for that in all different ways. And it would be easier for her life in some ways to go along with it in the beginning. I think as things escalate, she can't ignore her intuition anymore about it. And then she also meets this whole cast of characters that aren't really on the inside fold of this cult. They're more outskirts. They kind of live in a neighboring area. And it's impossible for her to maintain her original belief when she's seeing these people outside of the cult and some of their perspectives. It's just like when we read literature or we travel for the first time or we leave home, we're confronted with different perspectives and we're forced right. to reckon those with our core beliefs. And often that complicates things and that changes us instrumentally. And I think that's what happens with her here. And the women she meets, especially the women running the phone sex business, she's completely turned around in terms of the way that she sees women, the way she sees her body, the way she sees sex. And she really gets an education that's that's impossible for her to look away from.
I want to go to this phone sex business that the women from the outside are in, because there is this clear current in the novel about women doing sex work, right? I mean, there's the women who are doing the phone sex. There's also once Lacey's mother leaves, she goes to Reno, and the seediness of what's happening there is sort of alluded to that it might be pornographic, but you don't really say that. And I was wondering about girls and women who want to be stars, they're trading in their beauty. You know, I mean, you're clearly offering a bit of a commentary on this. So it's less of a question and more an observation and just a curiosity about what you wanted to get across by showing this world to your readers.
Yeah, I think for me, I wanted to show a little bit of contrast between the way that the phone sex business operates here and the way that where Lacey's mother eventually ends up working in Reno in a really different situation. I think the phone sex operation, the women are really holding a lot of power in that, even the way they are talking to the callers. And there's a sort of empowerment that's occurring, even though I don't know if in mainstream ideas they would see it as that. But I think in the book, it is empowering in a different way. And it's a way for these women to, I mean, they kind of think of themselves almost as counselors. Like they're literally the last house on the block for men to express desire or need that's not filtered by this kind of toxic masculine idea. And they do hold a lot of power in that. And also they're removed. So they're in a house. They're not having physical contact with anybody. And they've taken back some of their agency in that way, I think. But then in Reno, we see this other version where it's not healthy for the mother to be involved in that, probably. And it's a really different world. And I don't know. I don't want to make a general commentary on phone sex or on sex work in general, because I just don't know enough about it to do that. But I wanted to show different perspectives of what that could be like and mm-hmm. how that might work.
It was effective. So thank you. Yeah. I mean, it felt like the range of things that the women were doing and the levels of empowerment and the levels of, you know, men controlling them, there's quite a range clearly. If we could go back to California for a second. It plays such an important part in your book, and you grew up in the Central Valley, you went to Cal Poly, now you live in Oregon. I was just wondering about place and its importance. I mean, I also grew up in Southern California, and I'm a little older than you, but I remember so well growing up in drought and 3-minute showers and the impact that that has. And so I'd love for you to talk about this extreme drought that this town is in, and they seem almost like there's not even a consideration of leaving, you know, even to go to Fresno, or they just don't have options. And the role of place in Godshot and California's importance to you.
Yeah, I felt that writing about this place and to leave out the fundamental issues of its environment and the drought and the fires that always neighbor everything. You know, it's an interesting geological space in that it's a valley and it's really a bowl. So everything gets trapped there. All the toxic smoke from wildfires, you know, exhaust from cars, everything stays. It's like this atmospheric pressure that it's so bad. The air is so bad that often you can't see the mountain ranges that you should be able to see. And sometimes when we have a rain or it clears up, suddenly there's these gorgeous Sierra Nevada mountains, but really up close. And it's kind of confounding that they're even there. So it's eerie. That space has always been so ingrained in me. Obviously, I grew up there. Everybody has some tie to their hometown in that way. My grandfather, who ended up raising me after my mom left, he had started the agriculture program at Fresno State and was just very involved in the land. Even in retirement, he really held on to the weather systems, you know, this sort of obsessive thinking about frost, drought, you know, will it rain? What's going to happen to the harvest? That was always a topic of conversation. And I think that that was just in me, and it kind of came out in this book.
There's a lot of desperation and these incredible scenes you write where Lacey is drinking bottled water. It's like mana from heaven, and it's effective. You feel that certainly. I want to ask you about your writing. I read this in a Penn interview. I love this. You said, "I love reading my own writing. I love the act of writing. I always have. Long before I wrote anything that met the light of day, I write cackling at the screen, and why not? You have to have some swagger for your own art. There's a lot of rejection along the way. Don't reject yourself." It's so refreshing. I see so many writers doubting themselves in their writing, being so self-critical, in a lot of ways being their own worst enemies. So how did you learn how to be in relationship like this with your writing, or has it always been so?
I don't know that it's always been so. I think when I entered my MFA program, I didn't really know what I was doing in life. And very quickly in that program, I realized that being a writer was absolutely what I wanted to do. It felt like the purest truth I'd ever stumbled upon. And I felt like I would do anything to not let that go. And so I don't know, maybe it's entwined a little bit with just that determination of finally finding something that I felt like I could be good at. I wasn't a good student. I barely ever went to high school. I barely graduated. I barely went to community college. It was all sort of hanging by a thread until I found writing. And so once I did, I don't know, I guess it was the first time I felt like I could be confident in something. And that just kind of grew. And it is true that it was a place I was finding a lot of joy. Mm-hmm. And I did feel that could not possibly be bad, that certainly not everyone would want to read what I wrote or even think it was good, but that didn't seem to negate the joy that I was feeling. And so I guess now, I don't know, when I go to write, that's like, that feels like playtime to me. That feels refreshing and really fun. And I think if we start thinking too much about outcomes and, you know, you're writing alone. You're alone. You don't know if anyone's ever going to buy your book or read it. So that's scary. And I think it's easy to get hung up in all those unknowns and and really focus on the outcome. And it, I think as soon as I do that, it opens the door for too much trash to come in. I can't really create in that mind space if I'm worried about submitting or thinking about a reader on the other end. I hear that a lot from writers. It's not usually helpful to think about readers necessarily while you're writing. Maybe in some cases it works, but yeah, and then I think mainly though, becoming a teacher and hearing the insecurities of my students and hearing the same insecurity over and over, which feels really rooted in the question of like, do I have the right to be a writer? Am I a writer? Should I be doing this? Am I wasting my life? You know, and just hearing so much self-doubt and then asking, well, are you writing? And often the answer was like, well, not really. Cause I'm just like, I'm nervous or I'm worried. And it just seems so clearly how that is such a block for us. And it happens to everyone. Right. I remember reading The Artist's Way and she talks about the censor. That's the censor voice over here. That's ultimately so unhelpful. But I think not acting like it's not happening, but just being like, oh, that's my censor. Hi, censor. What do you have to say? I hear you. Thank you for that. You can go now. Like, it's the same thing about, you know, feeling an emotion really heavily, like anxiety. It's not trying to push it out or act like it's not happening, but being like, hello, hi, anxiety. I feel you. What message do you have for me? Okay, thank you. Goodbye. You know, I've just found that diffuses those voices and allows me to move on. I don't know.
I love that. Yeah. It's very helpful. And it's interesting because on the one hand, you're talking about joy and all of these things, but of course there's so much at stake with writing as well for people in so many ways. You've said that stories save lives, which also, I think for some people might feel like a pressure, even if they've been so inspired by a book that felt like it did save their life. And so this question is maybe twofold, like which book saved your life? And as you were writing Godshot, was that ever a pressure, you know, something you aspired to?
I think the first book that felt like that for me was White Oleander by Janet Fitch. I think it was the first book I read where it just hit the feelings I had right on the nose about this loss of the mother, where she's still in the world, but she's not accessible. And I mean, that's such a beautiful book. I mean, that is just like this sensational book. I'll never write White Oleander. That exists alone, you know, on the clouds of the literary heavens. It's this beautiful thing, but trying not to hold myself to that standard. I'm not Janet Fitch. How could I ever write White Oleander? But I can write something else that's true to me and will be true to my natural ability and style and inclinations, while also being so inspired by these writers who have created these works of such beauty that are really inspiring. But I don't know, as soon as I'm like, well, will I ever be as successful as Janet Fitch? I mean, that just slams the door in my face to anything I might ever do. You know, it's like, well, I don't know. I know that my path is not Janet Fitch's path, you know, so I can't compare myself. Comparison is the thief of that joy, I think. Mm-hmm. And I've heard that said a lot, and it's hard to do, especially having a book coming out. You're kind of conscious of things in a different way. But it's always unhelpful to compare.
Truth. Yes. Yes, it is. So thank you. And, you said that you come from a family of forgetters, and that's clearly not the role you're playing in your own life. So can you talk about what this means, and do you think that you're being drawn to writing is kind of a result of that?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this so much lately. And I think that my inclination to start writing as a child was because my world was so chaotic and often you know, when you're the child of an alcoholic or an addict, there's a peak of disaster. You're always riding a wave. And then there's the come down where it's the next day and like maybe they're not at that peak anymore. So things are either not talked about at all or they're brushed over, they're made okay in some way, or they're just lied about. And it creates a confusion where you're like, am I making things up? Am I experiencing the same things other people are experiencing? And as a kid, I was like, I need to write this stuff down so that I don't forget, so that I don't become confused by all these other truths that aren't reliable.
You originally wrote the story from the mother's perspective and then later realized the story had to be told from Lacey Mays. How did you know to listen to that voice?
Well, I heard it so clearly. I just remember waking up the morning after I had finished that kind of first fledgling draft, and it just said, write it from the daughter's perspective. And I heard it, and I think I spent like breakfast thinking like, no, I don't have to do that. I just did this other thing. It's fine. But I knew as soon as I was saying that it was wrong, that I would have to listen to that voice or at least experiment with the voice and see what was there. And I think it was truly just a way to get closer to the story that perhaps right at the start of things, I couldn't do yet. And, you know, writing from the daughter's perspective would be a lot closer to my experience than writing from this older woman's experience of being the mother and also looking back on the situation. It was so different, and it felt suddenly important to get a lot closer to the situation.
I came across this personal essay in Catapult that you wrote called Why We Must Believe Women, My Family's Legacy of Violence and Murder, which is quite frankly an amazing piece. I was very moved by it for all sorts of reasons. You're talking about the legacy of your aunt having been murdered, but there's so much about your own feminist awakening in that and how women are treated and your own anger. So thank you for writing it, first of all. And thank you for writing Godshot. But I wanted to read this little snippet because you have a daughter and you wrote in the Catapult story, I'd like to teach my daughter to protect herself. I'd like to teach her not to be thankful for the leering eyes of a man on the street or the groping hands of a man at a bar. I'll teach her that she is the ruler of her body. And I'd like to imagine a world where she can go to the grocery store at night and not walk fast to her car with keys poised like a weapon. Again, just very moved about the experience of being a woman in the world and this feminist awakening and what legacies we pass along to our daughters. And I was thinking about your mother and her legacy to you and your legacy to your daughter and wondered if you had any words you'd like to share about that experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think becoming a mother, I was so struck by the influence that I would ultimately have on my daughter. Just because I know the influence my mother had on me. And there's a lot of pressure in doing things right. But my goal, I guess, I'll never be a perfect mother. There's way too many things in the closet for that. But I can be a different mother and I can be really overt. I think one thing that was missing from my childhood that would have been helpful was just people saying the thing. Saying out loud, like, that's not okay if that happens to you. No one was saying that. And maybe they thought it was implied, but it was not implied if you're a child. So I say things really directly to my daughter. And I hope that we can keep that channel open. I mean, even just the way I try to talk about bodies or the way that I don't try to infuse shame in things like a menstrual cycle or, you know, she knows more at 5 than I probably knew about my anatomy at 25. I mean, and that's real. I think she's on a really heightened path that I was just not on. I felt like I was playing makeup, you know, once I kind of was cued into some of these different truths where I was like, oh my God, like all the ways that I was playing into some of the things we're just conditioned to as women. And it's also a survival. I was just surviving as well. And also, you know, thinking about my mother, I see the ways that she was such a product of the society that she was in and the people around her and the ways in which she was a victim of domestic violence. Mm-hmm. And what that does to a person is so traumatic, and it shut her down so completely. In some ways, as I get older, I'm able to see the ways that she was actually tremendously strong in the face of everything she was enduring. As a kid, you don't maybe see it that way, but the older I get, the more complicated it gets, because it's impossible not to recognize, you know, the ways in which no one was saying to her explicitly, this is not okay. And I hope that as a mother, I can just say the thing.
Well, you're off to a good start with this legacy of writing. So thank you for that, Chelsea.
Thank you so much, Brooke, for your wonderful questions.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Chelsea Beaker. I found her to be so refreshing and honest and forthcoming and fun to talk to. Women Lit events always leave me inspired, and I hope you'll check out www.womenlit.org and the Bay Area Book Festival's Unbound series for additional upcoming events. Grant and I will be back next week with our regular program. Right Minded is a weekly podcast. We're grateful for opportunities like these to collaborate with like-minded community events, and we're grateful to you, our listeners, for making Right Minded possible. We'll see you next week.